Hello? Hi, it's me, Ross Matthews, America's gay. Listen, I get it. Life is hard. Okay, we all struggle. Boyfriend problems, girlfriend problems, job problems, life problems. Which TV show to watch? Honey, I get it. You need help. That's why I'm here. I'm the gay best friend you wish you had, and honey, you know you need. It's Straight Talk with me, Ross Matthews. This is tough love, honey, but it's worth it, like plucking or waxing. Get your weekly gay pep talk right here on podcastone.com.
TrueCar is changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save an average of $3,221 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your savings certificate. Take it to the TrueCar Certified Dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app. That's right. Download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That is TrueCar, TrueCar.com.
This is Corolla Digital.
And welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Be sure to check out the 1, 2, and 3 volumes of those swinging sounds that you're hearing right now. And do all your shopping on Amazon by clicking through the banner at drdrew.com. Does not cost you a thing. It keeps wind in the sails of the Corolla Pirate Ship and keeps him from beating the shit out of me then. And be sure to support the sponsors of this show. They are great products. At least you hear me talk about these things because I like them. You'll like them. And it's my pleasure to welcome the program, Paul Mercurio.
Hey.
Paul's website is Paul Mercurio, MECURIO.com.
Right. You can't spell it MERCURIO because he's an Australian actor.
Oh, my God.
That's why I had to change the spelling of my name. Did I ever tell you this story?
No. So, I thought you were, to this moment, I thought it was Mercurio.
No, no. Well, that, my God-given name is MERCURIO, and when I decided to leave my other career to do this, after my mother had a heart attack, she's like, well, you're not going to change your name, are you? I'm like, no, I like my name. Nobody's got my name. So then I get my first part in a sitcom, and that gets me into the union, and my manager calls me and says, you have to change your name. I go, why? I think, well, because there's a guy named Paul Mercurio in the union.
Oh,
I'm like, get the hell out of here.
That's crazy.
Who would have that? So it was this guy that was in this little movie called Strictly Ballroom that came out of Australia. He was actually a choreographer on the movie, and the actor who was cast couldn't get the dance moves down, so they put this guy, and they're like, you know what? He can act good enough, and ended up getting a career out of this. His big claim to fame is Exit to Eden with Rosie O'Donnell, where they go to like a sex retreat, and she's running around in a teddy. So that's your image right
Rosie
there.
Rosie O'Donnell?
Yes. Yeah. It's called Exit to
Eden.
How
did I miss this?
Exactly.
Was it an Australian film or was it out here?
No, it's American.
Oh,
he did TNT Joseph. He played Joseph. So then what happened was I tried three names, Paul Michael Mercurio, my confirmation name, and that didn't work because, God forbid, people could figure out saying three names. They would call me Paul Michael Mercurio.
Yeah.
So then people were Googling me and getting him, right? And you go to his site, and he's like this hot choreographer dancer with like super tight pants and like literally like a white tank top, and he's got like a bottle of water that he's spraying on it. So people go to his site, and they go, I don't know you were doing gay porn. I'm like... It's not
me. But you're
looking
good.
But I look good, right? And I just dropped the first R in my name.
So you can get all of Paul's stand-up dates at his website. And more importantly, you can get the Paul Mercurio Show, which he's very kindly had me on. It's available at iTunes and at the website.
We're going to do another one with you. We
absolutely.
Only scratched the surface.
No, we didn't have time. I know. We got to absolutely do that.
Yeah.
But
wife was on it. She was fantastic.
My wife did it. He's done my wife's podcast, Calling Out with Susan Pinsky. And Paul's had amazing freaking guests. Paul McCartney, Corolla, Leno, Colbert. Incredible.
Mm.
No John Stewart, interestingly.
Not yet. I got to tell you the McCartney story.
Tell me.
But I need my phone. Can I run and get my phone?
during the oh he's gonna just, get it. Chris
just grab my bag is another thing. I could tell you later. I could tell you
well,
now. Do
you need the phone to finish it or
yeah
all right go ahead
yeah
because he'll bring it right in.
Paul McCartney was doing a special show at the Colbert Report, and I help out over there. Steven's a friend of mine. We used to work together on The Daily Show, and I kind of straddled both shows. Thanks, man. And so he's there, and he does rehearsal. And
Colbert.
Colbert, and yeah. Then McCartney comes in and does rehearsal, and there's a break. And I walk down the stairs, and in the hallway, standing all alone, leaning against the wall, like with one shoulder, chewing gum, staring up at the ceiling, is Paul McCartney. I mean, all alone, which threw me more than it was Paul McCartney. I'm not being rude. I'm just looking for something as I'm talking to you. And he is just standing there. And I'm now, as I approach him, my whole world slows down. I'm like, oh, my God, Paul McCartney. Like, do I talk to him? Do I not talk to him? Because there's like an unwritten rule, like, you don't bother guests on the show. But he's out in the hallway, like a gazelle on the Serengeti's plains. As far as I'm concerned, he's game, right?
And you're a big panther about to put your paw down on him.
Exactly, right? So I see him, and I'm walking toward him, and I'm saying, I'm just going to say hi, because I'll never get this chance again. It's one of the good things about being in show business, blah, blah, blah. And I'll get it over with, and that'll be that, okay? Hey, how you doing? I'm a big fan. Huh? What's your name? Paul. Oh, Paul, that's a good name. What do you do? Oh, stand-up. Oh, I love stand-up. Blah, blah, blah. We start talking. 5 minutes go by. 10 minutes go by. We're talking about his kid and touring and this and that. Now, on the outside, I'm all cool. Like, hey, on the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney. I was like every 16-year-old girl in the films from the 60s, right? And then I decide, you know what? I'm going to end this because I don't want to be the guy that stays at the party too long, right?
Yeah.
So I, just so you know how important I am, Dr. Drew, and everybody listening, I told Paul McCartney, hey, I got to go. Can't keep chit-chatting about
But I'm betting, though, that you did it as follows. I got to do my podcast. I got to do my podcast.
Right, exactly.
I got to go run and do my podcast.
Right.
You ever heard of my podcast?
Exactly. You totally. And I'm delusional, right? And I love to talk to people about process. Like, that's sort of, I guess if there's a theme to my podcast, like I'm just fascinated, especially musicians, because I have no musical talent at all, that they could hear all of that stuff and lyrics and music, blah, 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 and put it all together. So I leave. I actually go to the bathroom, and you met my wife, Carol, and I called her from the bathroom, the Colbert Report, like.
Shitting yourself, literally.
Right, exactly. And she's like, she goes, are you in the bathroom?
Who else is listening to this?
Right, exactly. What are you doing? I go, no, it's not Tuesday. I'm not masturbating. So I go, I just talked to Paul McCartney, and I hang up the phone, and then I think, because I'm delusional, he should do my podcast. Like, that's literally the conversation in my head, right? Mm-hmm. So I go back, and I say, you know what? You only live once, and I knock on the door, and I go, look, you're huge, and I'm nobody.
Did you ask anybody in the Colbert?
No.
And that's your bigger problem, right?
I know. Well, it worked out okay. Yeah.
But I mean, that's worse than, potentially more troubling for you than Paul saying no.
Yeah. And I said, I'd love to talk to you about making music, and would you do my podcast? And he goes, yeah, sure.
Whoa.
Just like that.
Whoa.
So fast that, you remember you were in high school, there was that really hot chick you wanted to ask out, and you were like, I can't, and she's never going to say yes. You know what? I got to just ask her. She'll say no. I'll get it out of my system, and I'll move on.
Yeah.
Except she says yes. And
now
you
what
have,
do you do?
You have no game plan.
Yeah.
I know. He goes, yeah, sure. And then I just was like,
blank.
And he goes, how would we do it? And I go, I blurt out, I'll come to London. And he's looking at me like, we're in New York, right?
Oh my God.
He said, is it easy to do? And I actually said, to arguably the most influential musician in the last 100 years. Yeah, it's super easy. I don't want to be a bother. You could do it naked from your toilet on the phone. I'm like, what am I saying? Right? So now I'm like completely like, I've totally blown this, right? Couldn't have been nicer. I go, look, I'll tell you what. I don't want to bother you. I'll go find your assistant. I'll ask her for set it up, blah, blah, blah. He goes, no. They'll muck it up. He goes, you and I will do it. I go, what?
Wow.
He goes, yeah, just.
Because, you know, they would have put a roadblock.
Oh, God. Yeah. He said, "We'll just exchange numbers."
Whoa!
So now my hand is.
So you're gonna play. You're gonna play a phone message from Paul McCartney for me, aren't you? Is that what you're gonna play?
So here's what happens, and I'm sure he loves that.
Playing his phone message all over the world every time there's a microphone. Listen to Paul McCartney's out of my phone. What if he was naked talking from the toilet?
This is only the 700th time I've played this. No, I haven't really played it that much because I've tried to be judicious, but I just brought it up. But anyway,
it's
so
my fault. You're right.
So yeah, you drew it out of me. I thought I got the nicest blow off on the face of the planet.
You.
Yeah, you put a gun
I
to my head.
You, yeah,
he did. He's holding me down. He's a very strong man, Dr. Drew. He's got guns. You do have guns. Every time I see you, you got.
I'm born with them. I work them out a little bit, and they get big. It's very simple.
Now, you're taking a special elixir that.
No, I wish. I've always wanted to do that. I never did. I never the balls to do it because I see all the horrible consequences.
Yeah.
You know.
So he.
Thank God. I would that my prostate cancer would have gone. Poof, would have exploded had I taken anything like
human
that.
Growth hormones and stuff. Like
any
that?
Well, not that one so much, but I'm not sure that one would really do anything for me. I'm interested in the anabolic androgenic steroids.
Well, that stuff feeds into that kind of thing. Like, if
Really? Oh, yeah. Particularly if you have it. If you have it, there's no doubt.
Even if you inject them right into your penis, that's what I've been doing.
Well, that's, yeah, it's pretty nearby the prostate.
My wife likes it. makes her...
I'm literally bugging my urologist, like, when can I go on testosterone? When can I go? Come on now. I'm old now. Let's go on testosterone. And they're like, 5 years.
I think
years.
I have a hemorrhoid, you know.
5 years. Can I see it? I mean, do you want me to look at it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, here's the thing. I was on a plane. And then it was like tough to, you know what I'm saying? I was
you got
pushing.
Some blood.
And I think I was pushing too hard.
You got
and then
some
all
blood.
Of a sudden, I'm like, hey. And then I thought I had like a little turtle head hanging out there.
Yeah.
It turned out, I think it's a little
that's
bulbous.
Hemorrhoid. Yeah, that's hemorrhoid.
So I put cortisone on it.
Yeah, good.
But my guy's saying I could probably go need to see a proctologist. What do they do?
Do not let them operate on it. The operation,
does it go away?
It goes away, or they come back and they go away.
It's like a little, like the size of like
yeah,
a.
Just
a quarter.
Take a stool softener and don't worry about it.
I did. I took
on.
The Cal's.
But make sure it's like really soft. And
should I not be talking about this
no,
on
no.
your podcast?
Here's if they band it, which is the old thing, or they laser, it hurts. At least unless they've been changed the procedure since I last put a patient through it, and then they come back anyway. So just. Just
all right.
Fucking deal
all right. Listen, I also have a third nipple. Can we talk about that?
You should get that. Guy's got to go. That's got to be taken off.
So McCartney.
It's half your routine right there. Is that third nipple? I know.
It is.
So McCartney, let's hear it. Come on.
All right. Well, now you like took all the air out of it. I was going to surprise everybody with it. All right. Now here's so he calls up. So what ended up he does a show and the phone rings and I don't recognize the number and I was rushing to go to the Daily Show and I let it ring the voicemail
does it start with 011? You know what I mean?
No. It's actually a New York number.
Local, okay.
Yeah, and this is a...
Hey, Paul. It's Paul McCartney here. I'm going to ring you back in 5 minutes to do the podcast thing. I've got some time now. Otherwise, I'm going to run out of time. So if you're there in 5 minutes' time, you got me. Okay, bye.
He's getting in his car.
He was in the car. He was on his way.
And there, you know what's interesting about that recording? There's no doubt that's Paul McCartney.
Oh, I know.
That's Paul McCartney.
So it's you make a really good point, because I had said to somebody once, if I had asked like a really great impressionist friend of mine who did impressions, I would have scripted it exactly that way. This is Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Like
as Paul McCartney.
As Paul McCartney. Right. Like he even needed to say it was Paul McCartney. Right. So now I'm standing at the corner of 52nd and 11th Avenue, screaming to the heavens, I just screened a call from Paul McCartney, uh-huh. And I'm never going to get him back, right? I call back, and I'm like, I need... Because I completely bullshit him. Like, I wasn't ready to do it. Because my studio is the Sideshow Network, which is here in L.A., I'm in New York.
Oh, my God.
And I called him at one point after I talked to him and said, I might have Paul McCartney for an interview in about an hour. And they go, well, the studio's busy. And I turned into this guy. Did you not hear me? I have Paul McCartney. I turned into that asshole guy, right? And so
who are you talking to over there? Just because I know all those guys. Just
Sean. Yeah,
of course.
Who's a sweet guy.
Just a producer guy. Yeah. He's Chris Maxapata over at Sideshow.
And he's a really sweet guy. But, you know, he's just like somebody's in the studio. Like, what are you going to do? And I was like, I had to say, it's Paul McCartney, right? So I'm like, I just screened the call and I'm never going to get him back. I call up and he goes, all right, I got it. And he gets on the phone and I'm like, I need a couple of minutes. And he goes, okay, but I don't have a lot of time, so I'm running to the next thing. I had to call him back three times to
Jesus.
Wait. By the third time, I'm like, look, I'm having a heart attack.
I would have given up.
I was like, look, can we just do it? And then he goes, nah, you got me now. This is a window. I'm like, okay. So we finally get a line. We did a Skype line. And I call back, and they go, hold on, he's in the bathroom. And all I can picture is Paul McCartney taking a dump, like the most creative dump ever. Like, he's a genius. Even when he poops, he's a genius. And then he gets on the phone, and... He did it, and he was fantastic.
And so can people get that one now?
Yep. It's on iTunes. And
how about over at Sideshow?
You can get it on Sideshow Network as well.
They have, what's the website over there? Sideshow.com?
Sidenetwork.com.
You guys double-check me on that, Gary. Yeah. And Susan, my wife's over there, too.
Yes.
People like her podcast. It's really...
She did
different.
It. Yeah.
Different.
Well, she's fascinating. I love her, and she's a great... conversationalist.
Yes.
And
that's the whole point of it. Sideshownetwork.tv.
.tv.
Sideshownetwork.tv.
And so I've talked to like a therapist from time to time. I've talked to like a life coach from time to time. Because, you know, I left another career to do this.
I want that story in great detail. We're going to get that in a second.
And so somebody said to me, you know, you should, you know, had put the thought in my mind, like, talk to a psychic or readers and clairvoyance. And then I met Susan through the guys at Sideshow.
People tell you? Who does she? She has some really good ones. Some are like phenomenal. Like, I can't explain how they do what they do. It's really crazy.
She had two women on the phone with me, and it had been at a point. This was about a month and a half ago, and I was dealing with some stuff with somebody who works in my world. One of my representatives, and she literally was like,
"Change.
You need to make a change. Yeah. I'm sensing you, and you
Susan
don't
told me this.
And you don't want to make a change." And
that was right. Huh?
And that's part of the reason I'm here now. So it's like, yeah.
So they were right.
Yeah. Oh,
intuition is the most. That's the next frontier. Human intuition.
But I'm surprised that you, and I said this to you on my podcast, that you, a man of science, sort of buy into that.
I don't buy into talking to dead people.
Mm-hmm.
I buy into that there's our right side of our brain has got a lot of shit going on that we don't know about.
But some people have
greater ability or have learned how to do something with it. I don't know what they're doing because I don't understand it yet. I just think there's something. Because I know when I work with patients, when I'm in that place and I'm mind reading, it's bizarre.
Is that part of what you're doing when you're working with a patient, essentially?
That's mostly what I'm doing.
But when you say mind reading, in that context, what do you mean?
It's kind of opening yourself to just focusing deeply, almost meditative focus on the other person, and then listen to whatever thoughts, feelings, somatic reactions occur. And then deciding, this is the art, which ones to reflect back to the patient and when.
You're making critical decisions in real time.
It's literally like if I feel like some overwhelming panic or something, I know maybe not to go wherever that is just yet if it's a first meeting.
Yeah.
But if I feel like a pain in my back that I've not usually felt, that's not my body, I'll go, you know, I'm feeling something funny. I wonder if you experience this, or, you know, and they'll always say yes. There's always something there, and because it's a communion, it's an intersubjective experience.
Really,
and if you really listen to yourself, you pick up on all kinds of stuff. I will say things. I will trust what comes out of my mouth,
right?
And I will say things that just shock me, and I'll just let it happen, and it has meaning to the patient. I don't know where I don't know what the fuck is happening. I don't know where it came
shock
from.
Shock you in the sense that it's sort of
dangerous.
Dangerous to
yeah,
say.
Well,
you told me the story. We talked about the story. You told somebody who was full of shit.
Right.
I've been full of shit most of my life.
I just decide whether it's a go or no go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is it time or not time to really.
Did you ever like have that come out and not work out the right way where it was a little too damaging?
I've had people storm out of the room, but they always come back and go, "How'd you know? Oh my God!" You know, and it's meaningful to them.
Yeah,
it's still meaningful for the patient.
This whole instinct thing is funny because there's a parallel to doing stand up and talking to an audience. I like
very much.
I'm not yours is much
more
substantive.
I disagree
and more
because
important.
I disagree because
you're helping people. I'm just being an idiot, a clown.
No. Because in those moments of a person in front of a crowd. Is how mobs behave and how human social groups behave.
It's so huge there.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
And so it's become.
And that's all right brain, too. We're not sitting there thinking logically as a group,
no.
But we're communing in some sort of weird.
Yeah.
You know,
I always say it's become about half my act now to the point where now I'm walking off stage and going into the audience and talking to people and bringing them on stage and talking with them and engaging them.
Oh, I love
and having
that.
Having them talk to each other.
Oh, I love that.
And I have the act, I have the material, but that just finds its natural place.
Yeah, you have stuff you go to out of it.
Yeah, but like I've had people tell me the most fascinating things, and people say to me, were they plants? I'm like, no. And how did it work out? I go, well, because if you just ask more than one question and you're patient, let the game come to you. In other words, don't worry about not getting a laugh within 30 seconds and really engage and really listen. Everybody has a story. Everybody's fascinating, and everybody's got something to say.
But most people, I will tell you, the where you're going to find the pushback. Well, comedians can't wait and stuff; they have to be in control of it. But people are afraid to ask questions. They're afraid to ask people personal questions.
Yeah.
And everybody wants you to engage on that level. That's what's important to them.
I just got here from Cleveland.
I find it bizarre for people to go, oh, I can't ask that. It's like, no, that's where the human is.
And by the way, you
want
to see get really tight white male comic talking to people of race about race.
Mm.
And it's great to talk about because it's and I say right to them. Like, I'm doing a bit where, and I'm not going to do the bit, but I talk about Larry Bird is probably my favorite professional player of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in New England. I'm a Boston Celtics fan. And I realized recently that part of the reason I liked him a lot was because he was white. And I related to him more than I did
black. No. It's more that you could imagine there's a possibility that you could be there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. If I grew a foot and I had some skill.
But the African-American athletes are too good,
right,
skilled.
Right,
there's
exactly.
No way you could compete.
Right, exactly. It's like I'm not going to even go to that place.
Awesome.
Right? And you could feel everybody's sphincter get tight for 30 seconds. And that's exactly what should happen in a comedy show, at least for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Because it should be something more than jokes that are like McDonald's fast food where you ingest
them. Do you explain
them.
That to them?
Say right out. I say straight up. The thing that works to my benefit is to constantly acknowledge the honest moment and not pretend it's not
listen,
there.
Hey, listen. White people are much more anxious about talking about race than African Americans.
And they're fundamentally decent. You know what I found?
Of course.
If I go to like Iowa and it's
But they appreciate the opportunity to talk honestly.
Yeah.
Because everyone tiptoes around.
Well, I talk about that there is some level of stereotype and racism in the world, and I have it. Now, as a white male, I'm not supposed to say that because theoretically I'm the oppressor. I'm at the top of the food chain and everybody's pissed off at me. Mm-hmm. Gays, Jews, blacks, Puerto Ricans, everybody. But I have them. And then I tell them I'm Italian. And when people hear that I'm Italian, they immediately think mafia or plastic on the furniture. That's what they think.
Yeah.
And they do. But it's okay.
Strangely,
because
it both.
Exactly. Because we're, as a European descendants, we're no longer the minorities, right?
Yeah.
But I have them about Puerto Ricans. I have some racist, stereotypical thoughts. I have them about Asians. And I have them about blacks. And blacks and Hispanics go on stage and do reverse racism jokes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
White people do this. White people do that. We laugh out of white guilt. And I got tired of it, so I addressed it. And people say, well, how do you get away with it? I go, because it's never mean. It's always honest. So as long as it's honest, and then you're in the moment, you get out of your own way, which is going back to what you were saying about the instinct. It's like you just... Like, I had...
You did a hand movement, I'm going to explain to Pete. You just did this,
which
means you're sort of channeling from... And you
the top of my head through,
just
down
through
my body.
Yes. Just letting it happen.
Yeah.
Just letting it channel.
Yeah.
Let it go through.
And
you're not here thinking.
No. And it's the hand movement.
How would you describe that, Gary? It's like...
Kind of like wiping down your body and pushing it away.
Well, he pushed it like a scoop out of his head, from his head to his body.
Down
it's like a squeegee off of his...
Yeah.
And it literally is like the most free... I'm the most free.
And by the way, you
on
need to
stage.
Get Lavelle Crawford on your podcast.
Oh,
you know Lavelle is? Lavelle.
I know him. I just don't know him. Yeah,
he's really, really great. I can put you in touch with him.
Yeah.
He and I had this conversation. Yeah. He is fascinating about it.
And so.
Great guy.
And audiences may not be IQ smart, but they're very emotionally smart, meaning they know in a split second if you're bullshitting them.
Oh, yeah.
I won't name this comic's name, but this happened at Caroline's in New York City. And he went up. The initials are AC. That's all I'm going to say. It was an urban crowd. It was a late night set. It was like the second show. It tended to be more urban in New York City. And a white guy goes up and just starts trying to be like black, like talking black and blah, blah, blah. And a black guy in front goes, he goes, what the fuck are you trying to be black for? You're Jewish. And the whole place. And he lost him for the rest of the show. Because he started the relationship.
He should have gone with it.
Exactly. He should have just been like. But the audiences are really. I was just at the Cleveland Improv. I just was there last night. And I, in the audience, were five black women sitting at a table. Middle-aged to 50s-ish. And two were identical twins.
Mm.
One of the identical twins was a lesbian, and she was there with her partner. And we just started talking, and I started playing with them. And they looked like one was very butch and looked like a butch lesbian, whatever. And then I started to ask her questions, like, when did you first come out? She goes, I realized, like, when I was in kindergarten, I had a crush on my kindergarten teacher. And you could feel the audience, like, not go, like, where's this going? And I don't know where it's going, and I don't want to know where it's going, because that's the excitement of it. It's the only art form where you can blow the whole room up, walk off stage, stand on your head, talk to anybody you want to talk about anything you want to talk about.
You know, that's all Adam and I do when we go out on the road together.
Yeah.
I sort of do the interview, and he does some interviewing too, but he adds the funny.
Yeah.
And we just use it as each person is a launching pad for something.
It's just, you know. I mean, it's fascinating. And what people will, perfect example. I'm in Phoenix. This is about a month ago. Had a military guy. Bring him on stage. Start talking to him. Nice guy. He says he's got all sorts of, like, he's like into guns and this, and he likes the fence. Like, oh, you like the fence? And there happened to be two mic stands up there. So I just grab a mic stand, and we start. And then I go, let's cross swords, right? So we put them together like this. And this guy, this is what this guy did. And this is proof that if you give people a comfortable space where they feel safe, they can be as brilliant as any comedian out there.
Oh, sure.
Right? He leans over. Now, mic stands have that little knob in the middle so you can extend them or drop them down. He leans over. Now we have, like, cross swords, and he pushes my mic stand down to make my penis really small. And it destroyed. Like, it destroyed. It was hilarious. This is a military guy with no performing training whatsoever. My point is that—
he probably did it with a timing that was—
it was perfect. It was perfect. And literally, he got off stage. I go, you son of a bitch, I am not going to top that laugh for the rest of the show. And I didn't. But the point is, and I get goosebumps talking about it, is if I didn't let that moment happen and didn't pursue that guy and then bring him up and whatever, not that it's all on me, but like— people are fascinating to me, and what they'll talk about and what you can get them to do and what they're willing to do is endless, as long as they feel safe and they feel like you're not going to compromise them for the sake of your show. That's the key, I think. And as long as you get out of your own way and not go, I don't know, should I say that he's got big arms? Or if I say, then by the time you're just all in your own head. Like, you just got to just go, you know what?
Right, you're following.
Every once in a great while.
You're following your instinct. That's where we started this conversation. Yeah. You're having a shared experience. I mean, humans relating to one another is so complicated and so magical.
Well, I just got tired of the dialogue in stand-up being, I tell a joke and they laugh. That's the conversation. Mm. It's not really a conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And people, like, my father was high school educated, put floors in for a living, so was my mom. But they're pretty bright people, had really good opinions about stuff and were very practical about life. Like, they were worth talking to, you know? And it's like, I had a guy on stage last night from West Virginia. He was a little drunk. A logger from West Virginia.
Interesting.
32-foot boat. And he likes to read poetry. And he talked like he was from West Virginia. And he even had tooth
missing. What kind of poetry?
He likes the classic American poets. Yeah, I'm telling you. And then he invited me on his boat. He invited me on his boat.
So this guy reads Edgar Allan Poe?
He reads the classics. And he just, his grandmother in West Virginia was a big reader. And he had to stay with her while his parents worked.
Where does family come from? That's my first. I just hear New England. I just it seems
no
to be New
West
England.
Virginia.
But no, but I mean before they came
maybe.
Down.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But you know, it's all and so. And you look at this guy, and he looked like a lot. He was literally like 6'3". He had hands like mitts. He had a tooth missing. He had a West Virginia Tech hat on, a grubby shirt, and he was half in the bag, but really interesting.
Oh, I'm sure.
And.
It's like character studies.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you get these people and you engage these people, and they'll tell you anything. I had a woman tell me that she
Or they'll tell you they can't answer it, and that's fine.
And that's fine.
You know what I mean?
And I know in a split second, if somebody doesn't want to play, I move on. Because I don't want to make it awkward. I don't want to put them in a situation where it's like, hey, you know, this is really weird and whatever.
No, absolutely. You're trying to be respectful.
But what's happened is it's opened up a whole world of sort of a show that now has sort of become this other kind of thing where it's stand-up, but it's sort of a conversation. So by the end of it, and I can do it in a theater too.
Oh, I'm sure. In fact, I bet theater works better. I bet you.
Yeah.
As long as you get mics into people's seats and not make them stand up or anything.
And you have a follow spot on you, and I have a cordless mic that I'm running around with. And I got to tell you, like, and the ones that work the best – if you do like a corporate show where it's pretty tight.
Oh, because they know everybody.
Well, they know everybody, and they just – it's like I do a lot of these corporate shows. Like I just did one in Vegas for Winco. It's like one of the biggest supermarket chains in the country. I never heard of it. It's out of Boise, Idaho. And, man, they were the loosest group of people. Like you were a bunch of white people from Boise with like tight, you know, sticks up their ass. And what I think the great thing is to allow people to see to have an experience that they didn't think that they could have.
Right.
Right. When you think of any experience in your life, like going to a music concert, you think it's going to be a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to a museum and I say, did you see that so-and-so's art exhibit? Yeah. Would you think it was all right? Was there anything you hadn't seen? No. Well, then is it really art? Is art on some level supposed to transform you or sort of be transformative in some way or take you to a place you didn't think you could go or even if it's uncomfortable? And so what I'm hoping is people walk out of there going, I don't know what the fuck that just was, but that was a crazy show.
How do you get into it?
I just go on stage, and the first thing I see that hits me, I want to talk about, I say it. It could be your hair. It could be your glasses. It's not.
So you immediately start talking to you don't have any sort of warming up period. You just immediately go right to the.
I just
the
go
audience.
Right on stage. Sometimes
right at the audience.
Sometimes if I'm annoyed that they're not clapping loud enough when I come on stage, I walk into the audience and I make them all clap until I'm ready. Any planning and any rules and any planning stop, because my whole life off stage is like. You know, you're a super busy guy, you scheduled this, that. That's the one place where if I want to stand there for 2 minutes in silence and sip a thing. I've gotten to the point now where I literally like go on stage as I write my bits down, because there are bits that I want
to
do, and if I don't write them down, I
you won't
forget.
Get to them. Yeah,
like,
I know.
So then I even had that honest moment where
This is the experience Adam and I have. This is what we do. We literally write stuff down on a napkin beforehand. And we don't have any idea if we're going to get to that. It's just if we need something to talk about,
right.
There it is.
Yeah, and I need a reminder. Yeah. And it got to the point one night where I go, look, I wanted to do this thing. And then I'll tell the audience, remind me to do this thing about shoes later, right? And then literally, like now, what I've done a couple of times, I just hold the sheet up. I go, you think?
Why didn't you remind me?
Right, exactly. And then I show it to someone. I go, what does that say? And she'll, I don't know, lazy eye is something I have. She goes, and then I'll just do it right off the. So there is no act anymore.
Right.
And even the things that I talk about, which is my need to confront people when things aren't right. Like, you know, I've almost gotten arrested in a couple of consumer situations.
Consumer situations?
Yeah. Like I pulled my pants down on 86th Street in Manhattan over a plastic supermarket shopping bag because the guy wouldn't give me a shopping bag and he told me he was going to do something dirty to me. So I told him I pulled my pants down and told him to, and then the cops came. And then I almost got arrested on the Amtrak. I stopped the train on Amtrak for a half hour.
Why?
Hold on. How?
There's a lever, right?
No. What happened was I was on Amtrak. We were leaving Penn Station going to Baltimore.
Hold on a second. We got to take a break.
All right.
We're going to come right back, and you're going to tell us that story. We'll be right back.
Hi, folks. I'm Larry Miller, but in a way, aren't we all? And this week, on This Week with Larry Miller, I get to tell you, folks, I love the Marines. I support them in everything. I'm glad my kid is a Marine. But I did something at Camp Pendleton after Thanksgiving that I challenge any Marine to beat. Listen for free through iTunes or visit LarryMillerPodcast.com.
The Dr. Drew Podcast is brought to you in part by TrueBrain. TrueBrain is a neuroscience company that has created the world's first drinks made from active neurotropics designed to improve focus, memory, and mental clarity. The Dr. Drew Podcast listeners can get their first supply at 40% off. I've actually used this stuff. If you remember, we had neuroscientist Dr. Andrew Hill on my show. He's a PhD, cognitive neuroscientist, and nootropic expert. So 40% off. Check it out at TrueBrain.com/Drew, D-R-E-W. Again, TrueBrain is a neuroscience company. It's created the first functional beverage made with active nootropics to improve focus, memory, and mental clarity. Many people are already leveraging TrueBrain to get things done. Users include writers, CEOs, athletes, programmers, lawyers, craftsmen, doctors, and podcast hosts. That's right. They gave me supply, and I've used it. TrueBrain comes in a monthly supply to your door, so the listeners can get their first box for $29.99. It's normally $50. By going to the link, truebrain.com/Drew. Again, the Dr. Drew Podcast listeners get their first supply 40% off, truebrain.com/Drew. Again, that is truebrain.com/Drew to get your 40% off your first supply. Back with Paul Mercurio. Paul Mercurio. Me Curio.
There you go.
MeCurio.com. iTunes and Paul's website, the Paul Mercurio Show. Also, the Twitter handle is @PaulMercurio. Facebook is /PaulMercurio. The sideshownetwork.tv is the internet address where you can get the podcast. And he was telling us about having stopped an Amtrak train.
Yeah. So just so you have context, I have a tendency that I think you need to say something in life. Otherwise, life runs roughshod over you. I really believe that.
Okay.
It's not an act. My wife is different. You met her. She's a little bit very sweet,
yes,
kind of quiet.
Quiet, yes.
And I'm like, I don't know if it's the Italian in me. I don't know what it is. But like, she's like, you got to let things roll off your back sometimes because you're going to get shot. You're going to say something to the wrong person,
yeah,
right? So I was on Amtrak, and I don't like making chit chat on trains with people. I just want to have my quiet time. So I put my knapsack on the seat next to me. And The conductor comes through and he goes, "It's going to be a full train. Clear the seat next to you." And I didn't, because it wasn't a full train yet. Nobody needed a seat. He came back through and he stood over me. He goes, "Hey, I told you it's a full train. Clear your seat right now." And I said, "Don't talk to me like that." He goes, "What?" I go, "You don't talk to me like that." He goes, "Why?" I go, "Because it's a consumer situation here."
And I, consumer situation.
And I paid. This is where my head goes, right? And I paid for this ticket two ways. One, I bought a ticket. And secondly, my
You're
tax,
lecturing him about how you paid.
Oh, yeah. I said, my taxpayer funds have been going into a fund for that's been funding this shit railroad for the last 30 years with lousy service. Is that okay if I swear? Is that okay?
Hell yeah.
Okay, and shitty service and disgusting bathrooms and disgusting food. So you can take your little hat and your chain shooter and go fuck yourself. That's 3 minutes into the trip. None of this is made up. So he looks at me like, what was that? And he walks away. And then he comes back through and he's taking tickets. So I'm holding a ticket in my hand and I go to hand him my ticket. He goes, "I'm not taking your ticket. You're getting off the train." I go, "Yeah, right." He goes, "No, I call the cops. You're getting off the train in New Jersey. I don't like your attitude." I'm like, "Yeah, right." We pull into the Newark, New Jersey train station. There's four cops standing on the platform. The son of a bitch called the cops.
I'm sure.
So now I used to be a lawyer. I go into lawyer mode. I'm like, I'm going to go find the head conductor, the manager. I'm doing air quotes for everybody listening. And I'm going to get this guy ratted out as a Nazi fuck and I'm going to get him fired. Okay. So I take my ticket. I run down. And as I'm running down the aisle, I hear a guy. I go, "Yeah, we're going to be like 20 minutes late. Some asshole stopped the train." I'm like, "That's me. I'm the asshole," right? Right. So I take the ticket.
Said that out loud?
Oh, yeah, I did. Oh. I go, "That's me. I'm sorry." Yeah. So I have the ticket. Now, Amtrak has these doors where you hit the black button and it's a big silver door and it goes into a pocket. I hit the pocket, the door, with the ticket, with my hand with the ticket in it.
Oh, no. Ticket
and the
goes
suction
in.
Got sucked. The ticket got sucked into
Jesus
the pocket
Christ.
Of the door. So now I'm illegally
now
on a train.
You're in trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
And I got four cops coming down and Wyatt Earp with his little chain shooter. And I'm right. So I'm like, shit. So I hit the button again. The door comes out. Nothing. In, out, in. Now I'm like, go from Mr. Macho, like, "Oh, my God, I'm going to die." Like, I was a huge pussy, right? I'm like, "One more time. Please, God." I hit it one more time. The door comes flying out and the ticket comes flying out of the door. And I grab it and I keep going.
Wow.
And I find the head conductor and I go, "Look, you got a guy who's crazy." He goes, "Look, I can't talk to you. There's a guy. He stopped." I go, "That's me. I'm the guy. I'm the guy." So we get with the cops and
how did you find the head conductor? How did you even find him?
She had a red tie on, so I determined that red was more, and everybody else had a blue tie on. So I figured red meant
something. You just were walking through the train looking for something that would trigger you?
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. So I said red, and it was I got lucky. And he's like, we get to the guy with, so it's the four cops, and now everybody's like looking out the window, right? And it's the four cops, me, the conductor. And what's the problem? What's going on? And the conductor's like, "I don't like this guy's attitude. He wouldn't take his bag off the train. He's very argumentative. I want him arrested." And the cop goes, takes a beat. He goes, "You want me to arrest him for that? If I arrested him for that, I'd be arguing. I'd be arresting my wife every 5 minutes." He goes, "Get back on the train."
Oh, wow.
And got back on the train.
Were you spitting a lot of lawyer stuff at that point, too? Did you say, "I'm a lawyer. I'm never getting my lawyer"?
Well, I never say that. But what I did say is, like, I said, "Look, he was inappropriate. You know, this is not a government. This is not, I think because you have some, like, fake badge on your hat that you think you're like a government official or like a law enforcement authority. You have to talk to people like a human being.
Yeah.
I'm paying for the service."
Yeah.
And then I got back on the train just to be a dick as he was coming.
Oh no!
I took my bag and I put it back on the seat next to me, and he didn't say anything. He just walked by like he didn't even want to be bothered, and stuff like that happens.
At least he wasn't. At least that guy wasn't sick. If he had been a colossal a-hole himself, this would have been.
This
could have gone to bad.
And then
places.
I got into a big confrontation. This actually ended up being an essay that I wrote for the New York Times Sunday Magazine called "Consumer Man." I call myself Consumer Man because I think I fight for the rights of consumers, in my own. So I got into
Dusty
a big
bare ass on 86th Street.
I got in a big fight with an Indian newsstand guy who wouldn't give me a plastic bag, who I'd been giving my business to for 4 years, and he wouldn't give me a bag. And I started an argument, and then he said to me,
"Did he recognize you?"
He knew me, yeah. And I was like, "I want a bag." He goes, "No, I'm not going to give you a bag." I'm like, "I want a fuck." And I'm like, "No, this is where my wife comes in and goes, like, just walk away. You really need a bag? I was going to the gym, and it was raining out, and I wanted a bag."
Stop going to his stand
right,
now.
Right, but I have to take the hard way, and I don't learn, and I keep.
So Paul doesn't believe in the invisible hand.
No. No.
He believes in using his own.
My wife believes that these things keep happening to me until I learn the lesson that I have to learn.
Right, right.
And I don't learn the lesson.
Right.
So we got into this thing back and forth, and one thing led to another. And he says to me, "Don't talk to me that way. I'll fuck you up properly. And he said properly to me, which completely threw me because I had never been insulted that way in all my life.
Did you say properly?
Am I properly? What does that mean? And I started laughing, right? And then he says to me, we kept going, and then he came out from the newsstand, and he kept going, and then he goes, don't talk to me that way. I'll fuck you up the ass properly. And I said, you want to fuck me up the ass? And I pulled my shorts down, and my ass is hanging out, and I'm screaming, I want a bag, and I want it now. And I'm just slapping my ass on 86th Street. And now, and then
you need some medication. What is wrong with you?
I know.
Dude?
And then he started backing up. Like, he was like, holy
shit.
Yeah, this
guy's
right?
crazy.
And then the cops came over, and this is all they need. Like, they're trying to fight crime and terrorism. And they're like, what the fuck? And I'm like, woo, I want a bag. That's all I could do. And all I could do is I looked at him and go, he wouldn't give me a bag. Like, that was my whole explanation for the. So
you said they arrested you though.
They took us in and they charged me for disorderly and they dropped the indecent exposure and they said keep your nose clean for a month and all this.
You had to
go
to court. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's just.
Was that when you were a comedian at that point?
I don't know if this is like from my law training. I got confronted. I don't think it is. I just you know where I think I learned it from? My mother. I grew up in my mother's furniture store, literally selling furniture. My mother, in the 60s, started a business when it was unheard of for a mother, let alone an Italian mother, to work, let alone start her own business. She started selling tchotchkes, little glassware and stuff, out of our apartment in Providence, a little tenement house in Providence, Rhode Island, and built it up into a full-fledged furniture store. But she doesn't take shit from anybody. So salesmen who represent the furniture companies would come in to try to get her to buy lines of furniture in the middle of the day, and she'd yell at them like, I told you not to come in here. Like this little Italian woman screaming at this guy, and this guy would put his tail between his legs and run out. And I think I got it from her because my father wasn't like this.
Yeah.
So it just has become this thing with me where, like, I'm the guy that always has to speak to the manager.
All right, I got to get you to tell your whole story about how you got to comedy. It's one of the greatest stories ever.
Okay, all right.
So starting with your family and their hopes and desires for you.
Yes, my being of Italian descent, especially, I think it's a parent's hope that, especially if you go to high school, that your boy or your daughter goes on to get a college education and maybe even becomes a lawyer, a doctor,
Ooh,
or a dentist.
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I ended up becoming a lawyer. I went to Georgetown Law School, and I ended up in New York City working at a big M&A, a corporate law firm doing mergers and acquisitions deal, and then an investment bank doing M&A deals as an investment banker.
Well, no, you're going to tell the whole story. You're going to tell the whole story. So you're at a law firm to begin with. Where'd you go to law school?
Georgetown.
All right. So you go to extremely selective, prestigious law school.
Right.
Did you know you wanted to do business law?
Yeah, I was an accounting major and almost became a CPA at a big eight accounting firm.
Okay,
and
so you had business acumen.
Yeah.
You saw dollars there.
Yeah, and I did well in undergrad. I didn't go to like an Ivy League school, but I did really well in school. I went to Providence College,
right.
But I did like really well.
Okay.
Business was good. Business was good for me.
Well enough to get Georgetown Law School.
Yeah,
which is like ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then you're there and you see, well, are you thinking, where can I make the most money? Is that the thought process?
No, I just
knew, I don't want to be a court lawyer. Or
no, I knew I wanted to do business and law, and that's all I knew. I didn't know – you don't really know a whole lot coming out of law school, right? You kind of know the book learning part, but practicing law is different. They say like – law firms don't make money on lawyers until their third or fourth year because that's when they can truly run deals. You have to learn how to be a lawyer.
In deal making,
yeah.
And even in
litigation.
Experience in tough situations.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you go in under somebody's wing kind of thing?
Yes, usually, okay. Yeah. You go in, like, and it was a big group. And it's, you know, from all like the up, like the Harvards, the Yales. Like, there was, like,
everybody's from the big schools.
20, yeah,
they're
25
all, it's
of
downtown Wall Street.
Big, big, huge.
Mergers firm. And acquisitions.
Yeah.
And you're under somebody.
Yeah, and
do you quickly distinguish yourself?
Yes, because I was one of the few guys that was willing to do M&A deals. Because M&A meaning mergers and acquisitions, so because those tend to they're really time intensive, lots of all nighters. You basically give your life away.
But there's also lots at risk. I mean,
yeah.
And people must get very anxious. And
yeah, yeah,
and yeah,
yeah. And it's multi-billion-dollar deals, and a lot of the ones I was working on were hostile. So you have to do that under kind of cover of night. Literally, there would be code words for the deal. You couldn't talk about it. Couldn't talk about it to my girlfriend, who's now my wife. None of that stuff.
So you're trying to orchestrate hostile takeovers of multi-billion-dollar companies.
Yeah, and we were
2 years out of law school.
Yeah,
We were, yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, yeah. No, so, I wasn't. I mean, there were a team of us, but I was like, there were.
You were the youngest.
Yeah, there. Yeah, and I in my class, and there was one other person. We were the ones that were like, okay, these guys get it, and these guys are willing to do it.
Did you get paid more for that?
No.
Did you get stature or status?
I think, but yeah.
Okay.
It kind of
so,
puts
so
you on
it was
track.
Distinguishing, right? Distinguishing
yeah.
your career.
Yeah, and so they literally. Drew, they would back a truck up of work. Like you, I would pull 3-4 all-nighters in a row, go home for 4 or 5 hours, sleep, go back, working 100 hours a week. I mean, I was getting paid really good money, you know what I mean? But yeah. I'm not going to complain. And I was learning a hell of a lot. And I was working on really cool stuff with like these big
like who you, can you say who you were across
T-Boone
the table from?
T-Boone Pickens.
So here you are 24 years old across the table from T-Boone Pickens.
Yeah, the owner of...
Do you guys know who T-Boone Pickens is? Like one of the biggest oil tycoons in the world.
The owner of Tom Hicks of Hicks and Haas, the owner of the Texas Rangers. We sold Dr. Pepper. The guy that ran, I don't know if you remember, Shearson Lehman, the guy that ran Shearson. Like these are guys like, yeah,
legends.
And I'm just sitting there going, okay, just don't say anything stupid. Just don't say anything stupid. Right?
All right.
And
so you got burned out doing that.
Well, I didn't feel like I was burned out. I don't know what happened, but I and it was funny because I had the responsibility by my second year of taking care of this brilliant partner who was completely socially dysfunctional. This guy's name is Larry.
Like an Asperger's dysfunction? Or?
No, just like so brilliant he doesn't give a shit and he does whatever he wants and everybody puts up with it because there's nobody. And my uncle was like that. And I believe things do happen for a reason. I had an uncle, my Uncle John, who was the most, my mother's brother. They could only afford to send one kid to school. It was John. And cut me off if I'm getting off the foot too much.
Go.
And he was a dentist and he was brilliant. But he literally walked around with like his pants unzipped, and he would work as a dentist on you while he smoked Viceroy's, and he would spill like ashes on, and nobody cared because he was like the best dentist in the state. But he was racist. He didn't like black people. He was out of his mind. He was out of his fucking mind. But people put up with it because he was so good.
Yeah.
And this was Larry to a T.
Okay.
And I was the only one who could work with Larry because I got a kick out of him because Larry was my uncle.
Yeah.
So I never took any shit from him and I knew how to handle him.
Yeah.
So like you'd go in and the first thing every morning you had to know is the New York Post cover to cover because he liked to talk about like, you know, who's sleeping with who.
Yeah.
But he's the kind of guy like you'll sit in a meeting with the brightest of the brightest on Wall Street for 12 hours trying to figure out a structure for a deal. And he's sitting there just like thumbing through newspapers, eating bagels and like disheveled, like pants unbuttoned, like schmutz on his face. And then at some point, he doesn't say anything for like 2 hours and he looks up and he goes, look, why don't we just do a 562 3-end back end merger and we're done. And everybody's like, holy shit, that's exactly it. He goes, are we done here? And he gets up and he walks out. Like it's literally like out of a movie. So I was assigned to him too.
Yeah.
But it was so exciting. I'm a middle class Italian kid from Rhode Island. I'll get this stuff. So then I start, and I don't know why. In law school, I started to have ideas from short films. And that I wanted to do. I always loved comedy.
Wait, are we still on the law firm?
We're still
now?
In the law firm, but I'm going back for a second to give you a little context. So what I did when I got out of law school was I bought a camera. And I started making some short films.
In your free time?
Yeah.
In your 100-hour week?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I made one. I shot it on 16mm black and white. It cost me $12,000 at the time. And I took 2 days out of work, told them I was sick, got a location around the corner from my law firm, which was ridiculous. I was a nervous wreck that I was going to get found. And it got into all these festivals, including the HBO Aspen Festival.
What was the film?
It was called Gloves. It's about a guy that sells a pair of gloves, and you reveal that he's got one arm and one leg missing because he's got a lot of anger issues and stuff. So, and I ended up at a young filmmaker's luncheon with Spike Lee, the Hudlin Brothers, Albert Brooks, and Woody Allen in the hills of this guy Peter Guber, this huge Hollywood producer. In Aspen, Colorado. And then I'm like, okay, so I got that bug. And then I start writing jokes as a hobby, and I don't know why. And I'm writing jokes, and a lot of them. Like, and I have a secret password file at work, and I was writing these jokes. I had like 15 pages of jokes. I loved watching stand-up, but never thought I would do stand-up. I was just writing this stuff. And I got to see Jay Leno one night at a private function.
When would you write? Like in the middle of these M&A meetings?
Yep. Yeah, and I would, or like on the way home at night, or if I'm lying in bed and I can't fall asleep, I'd kind of jot something down, you know, and I just would sort of whatever. And some of them were good, a lot of them were crap, but like I didn't know what I was doing. I was just writing stuff that I thought was funny to me. And then Jay Leno was at a private function, and he would, my firm had some affiliation with, and I got invited to go. And I was like, I got too much work, I can't go. And my friend's like, the other source, like, go, you know, whatever, go. It's like an hour. I'm like, all right. And I'll never forget this. I'm standing up and I'm putting my raincoat on and I'm standing over my
computer. He's down in the hallway by himself chewing gum looking at the ceiling?
Exactly. Will you do my podcast? Before podcasts were invented, I was like, and I hit the button on the print button on the thing and I printed out all the jokes. And I went to the thing and he performed. It was 150 people. It was a private function. And then I went up to him afterwards and I go, hey, I don't know if you need jokes, but I'm a big fan and I have jokes. And this is when he was like just starting to do The Tonight Show and permanent host of The Tonight Show. And I gave him my stuff and he goes, yeah, all right, I'll take a look. And then he goes, hey, come back here. I go, what? He goes, you might want to put your name and your phone number on here so I know how to reach. I was so like, here I am, Mr. Big Shot. I didn't put my name and my phone number. And next day my phone rings and it's Jay Leno. And he said, I read the stuff. He goes, I need jokes for the monologue. I'll hire you. Don't quit your job. He said, if I use something, I'll pay you. I'm like, shit, all right. He goes, by the way, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. He goes, I knew it. I go, why? He goes, you're too wordy. Your setups are too long. You write like a lawyer. He goes, you don't think you'd be so exact. I don't need stage direction, like make funny face here. I've been doing this for 15 years, right? I don't know what I was doing, right? Week goes by. He calls me again himself and says, I'm going to do one of your jokes on The Tonight Show. He does that joke on The Tonight Show. He pays me $50 for that joke, and it blows my head off my shoulders. So
you got high from it? Like you're hooked?
I was like, it was insane.
You're hooked.
I was like, now I'm like, yeah. I'm literally would go to deal meetings with two notebooks. One was for the deal, and one was for jokes, and I was not taking any deal notes.
Was it was it him telling the joke or the audience reaction or hearing
your joke? It took me a while to figure that out. It's a great question. Yeah. I think what it was that – at the end of the day, I like to sort of be at the epicenter of the creation of something. And as an attorney and then an investment banker, you're always one step removed. You're whispering in the ear of the guy who's at the epicenter of the deal. It's not your deal. You're invested in it insofar as you want to do well and get a bonus and whatever.
But is that why you went over to investment banking?
Yes, to get a little closer. Investment bankers are a little closer to the genesis of the deal.
So somehow, instinctively, I don't know if it was a full form thought for you yet. You were moving towards that.
Yes. Yeah. And I think to this day, if I stayed on Wall Street, what I would have ended up doing was going into a private equity fund that where you invest an equity.
Or would you just build a business?
Or build
just a separate business.
Yeah.
I just furniture.
The create. Right, exactly. Or plastic bags that I would sell that I would let people have for 5 cents.
Run a private train system.
Right. Run a private train system where I don't yell at people. So I think what it was that I created something out of thin air and he told that joke and people reacted.
That's interesting.
And then the shit hit the fan, and I didn't know it. Because what happened was he says, oh, go try the jokes out before you send them to me. And I go, well, how do I do that? He goes, well, you can go to open mic nights, bar rooms. They have open mic nights. And I'm like, okay. So I found out about a place, and I started to go to do these open mic nights when I had a dinner break for an hour. All the other associates were going to eat.
So, Larry, you're doing these five-day runs with no going home, doing an M&A
right.
deal. And at dinner, you go out to a Caroline's
right.
or something.
Right. It was worse. It was called one of them was called Downtown Beirut 2. Two. I'm not making this up. I am not making two.
And where was it?
Yeah, it was down in the Bowery.
It wasn't too far from where you were.
No, it was far because we had moved our offices and they were up in the 50s. So
oh,
it was a hall.
Shit.
Yeah, and
you
it was literally.
Take a train down, or what'd you do?
No, I would have a whole routine.
The
I had
car.
A town car. Oh. But what I would do is I get in the town car. And I would take my suit tie off and my jacket. I'd try to mess up my hair and try to look as downtown as I could because this was a fucking pit. This was like literally when people on the streets.
You're walking in there with your Brooks Brothers pants.
Oh, exactly. And the people in there, there was a hooker worked out of there. They dealt drugs out of the bathroom. There was a sign on the men's room door that said the toilet seat is only to use to go to the bathroom, not to cut coke. Thank you, the management. That was a sign, and it said, thank you, the management.
Oh, my God.
There were people on the streets borrow money from you to go drink, and you go, where do they go to drink? They would go to this place to drink. It was literally like a functional Cheers.
Got it.
And I would go there and I'd have the car drop me off about a block and a half away in the shadows because I don't want anybody to see me getting out
sure.
of a town car.
Sure.
I'd leave my stuff in my bag and I'd like, take my shirt tails out. I'd try to look downtown and I'd go and I'd wait. So one night, I'm waiting to go on stage and there's a guy on stage playing Blowing in the Wind badly because it was for poets and folk singers. And there's a scuffle at the pool table and this huge guy Bald had shaved head with a tattoo of a cobra on the back of his head. I'm serious. And a one-piece leather unitard thing. Gets in a fight with another dude. And the guy with the tattoo runs out of the bar, and the other guy grabs his neck and starts screaming, "He cut me, man! He cut me!" And it was a drug deal gone bad, and he cut him with a box cutter across the neck. Not deep enough that he died, but he was bleeding a lot. He was super drunk. Yeah. So he's like, "He cut me!" And the girlfriend starts crying, "Oh, look at my boyfriend! He cut me!" The answer, my friend. The guy just keeps playing like he's not getting off stage because he's been waiting like a month to do his song. He's not getting off fucking anything,
God.
Right? So now I'm sitting at the bar in my little Brooks Brothers outfit waiting to go on stage.
Uh-oh.
And I think the show's over. I literally start to walk to the door, and the MC goes, "All right, you guys ready for comedy?"
Oh.
And the guy, swear to God. Now the cops are in the place, and the guy's bleeding, and the girlfriend's crying, and I go on stage, and I've been doing it like a month. I had no clue what – I go, "Hey, it's nice to be here at Downtown Beirut, too. I always wanted to follow a slashing." So the guy heard me say slashing, and he had all these bloody cocktail napkins that he was like sopping up the blood, and he goes, "Hey." He goes, "You're making fun of me. I don't need to take any shit from you, you little son of a..." And he charges the stage, and he takes the napkins and he throws them at me, and they bounce off my shirt. So now I have
your
like
white Brooks
my
Brothers
Brooks Brothers shirt. And I have a blood stain on my shirt now, right? Now I'm thinking, okay, this is God's message to get off stage, but I'm so obstinate, like I'm going to stay and get through this. And he basically goes, nobody's listening to me at this point, right? It's just mayhem. And he turns back and he's wandering. He goes, "I'm going to get him. I know where he lives." He's super drunk. And he turns back to the stage and he goes, "Hey, everybody." He goes, "What's this guy doing?" Someone's like, "He's trying to tell jokes." He goes, "Oh, yeah?" He goes, "I like jokes. Hang on a second." He turns back to the bar. "Hey, everybody, shut the fuck up. This guy's trying to tell jokes." And the whole place shuts up because you have a crazy screaming bleeding man. You're going to do what he tells, right? I finished my set. It was like the best two minutes I ever had, right? And I get back into the car. I dress back up because it was like I was living a secret double life. Like
yeah.
I couldn't let anybody in that world knew.
They would not have dug it.
Right. And I couldn't let
anybody. You got blood on your shirt.
And I couldn't let anybody on Wall Street know that I was a comedian because they wouldn't let me do deals.
No.
So I go back. Now I was supposed to be going
an hour. It'd be disgraceful.
Exactly.
Disgraceful.
How dare you? Mercurio. I was supposed to be gone an hour. I was gone like 3.5 hours.
Uh-oh.
So it's almost midnight, and the senior partner's there, and he's never stays past 6. He's this like corner office
Uh-oh.
Guy. There's like 15 lawyers and bankers in this room. The deal, there's
you
a problem.
You come out with blood on your shirt.
Now I turn to you. Like, you know when you're 12 and you think you're going to pull the wool over your parents' eyes and they completely see through it because you're an idiot?
Yeah.
That was me. I got a file folder, and I thought, I'll just put the file folder here by my blood stain, which is right where my rib cage is, and nobody will notice. And I'll just walk around like this for the next 3 fucking hours, right? And the guy just starts screaming at like your father does. You're like, where have you been? What have you been doing? Why do you have a blood stain on your shirt? And I was like, I'm dead. I'm dead to rights. And then all of a sudden one of the other lawyers goes, well, that's quite a stain. What kind of shirt is that? I go, Brooks Brothers. He goes, I got Brooks Brothers shirt. I know how to get blood out of a Brooks Brothers shirt. He goes, club soda and lemon juice. And I'm like, what? And then he goes, now, Armani, that's the shirt you want when you get stains. They started competing with each other. And I was like, that's good. Oh, I think my phone's ringing. And I literally like ran out of the conference room. And that became my life. I was, you know, just trying to. And my girlfriend didn't know, who's now my wife. We were living together.
She didn't know you were doing this?
No.
Your parents surely didn't know.
Nobody
knew.
I was having a nervous breakdown. I didn't tell anybody.
It was your affair with comedy.
Yeah, exactly. And I basically, once I told my girlfriend, she's like, oh, thank God. I go, why? She goes, well, I thought you were cheating on me.
Yeah.
Because why? She goes, well, you were coming home reeking of beer and cigarette smoke. You had blood stains on your shirt. You had women's phone numbers, and those were phone numbers of other comedians who had rooms that you could work.
Wow.
So she put together a whole other story.
Oh, my God.
And then I started to work the bigger clubs. And then
wait a minute. But now you leave the law firm. You're actually going up the food chain.
In the midst of this, I leave and I go to investment banking. This is how fucked up I am. Like, I still am not up. Now I'm like straddling 3 worlds, right? Law, investment banking.
Were they pissed that you left the law firm?
They were a little surprised and disappointed because I was on that track.
They invested a lot of stuff in you.
Yeah, and I was on that kind of track to like.
Did they understand why you go to IB?
Yeah, I mean that was a track that quite a few people took, you know, because the IB guys were making quite a bit more money.
Now you're going on to the actual deal side.
Yeah.
Now you're going to closer to the ownership side.
Yeah, 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 and that meant going out to like Phoenix, Arizona, to sell an HMO, which is still there, called Pinnacle West, and spend a month and a half there going through their books and ripping them apart to see if there's any exposure.
The whole exposure, meaning like liability exposure?
Potentially,
or?
Yeah. You go in, when you're selling a company, you got to go in and first kind of go through everything, legal side and the financial side, to see if there are any hiccups, to see if there's anything that could potentially affect the value
of the company. So you're 6 weeks in Phoenix, and are you itching to do comedy? Do you do comedy while you're out there?
Not in Phoenix, but in other cities I did. I found places. I was like an alcoholic.
So you just keep going. Yeah,
yeah, I was completely like an alcoholic.
And when did you give in to your addiction? When did you capitulate?
What happened was I reached the point where I was like, this is too much. I can't keep this up.
Yeah.
Like, because I was literally like, I was doing, I did a show one time in New York City, and one of the partner's wives came in with some friends.
Oh.
Yeah. And I said, please put me on at the end of the show after the main audience leaves. I'm like, why? Just tell me. Like,
couldn't do it.
Just the life alone of being on Wall Street was stressful enough, let alone adding this.
I can relate to this, not to bring myself into this so much, but I did this with radio. This is sort of my life with radio.
Well, when you were doctoring and you were moonlighting?
Yeah, because I couldn't use my real name.
Right.
They judge you. It's disgraceful.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was important to do. I was talking about AIDS and safe sex.
Yeah.
And I was talking about – and back then that was crazy shit to talk about on the radio.
Yeah,
are you kidding?
Right.
You talk to kids about sex. How fuck? What's the matter with you? and so it was literally the same thing.
Yeah. And it just got
– For me, it the denial broke down when they went to 5 nights a week, when it was like, okay, now you got to change things. You're either going to do this or not do this. You know what I mean?
And how hard was that to pull that trigger?
Really hard.
Yeah.
It was sort of my wife. Susan was – she was pregnant with triplets, you know. Mm. And she's like, well, if you can get a job, if you get paid – because I wasn't getting paid doing radio for years, 10 years. And she goes –
While you're being a physician.
Yeah, my job was being a physician.
Yeah.
Radio was like my community service, yeah, as I saw,
right.
But still on the DL because, you know. And she goes, hey, you're going to get paid now. You're going to get paid. That's a job now.
Right.
I thought – oh, it's a job. Mm. Okay.
Mm.
So anyway, so you're in IB now.
Yeah.
And how long did you do that?
I did that for about 2 years, and I was...
Did you like it?
I liked it. I liked the people I worked with, and I liked sort of being closer to the epicenter of the deal. Yeah.
You like it more than law?
I think I did, yeah.
You were probably applying all that and more.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's
and
very...
And your accounting
it's
and stuff
fungible,
came in.
Yeah, it's all like, it's all right there. And
then why the capitulation?
I basically said to myself, if I look back, I don't want to regret. Look, in the midst of all of this, my father dies unexpectedly of a heart attack. And my mother's... I go home to the funeral, and my mother's 60-something at the time, and she goes... my brother works with autistic children, severely autistic children. He runs a hospital for severely autistic children, and my sister's a nurse, and I was the only one with a business background. And she goes, I think you should take over the business. And I'm like, oh, that's why Daddy died. Everything happens for a reason. I'm not supposed to be a lawyer, a banker, or a comedian. I'm supposed to come home and run this business. And I tried that for a while, and that was a complete clusterfuck because my mother would not give up any control, and I was 12 again, and I was supposed to sharpen pencils and get coffee, and my mother's insane. So my father's role was my father's role was to keep my mother. My mother grew up in
keep
the Depression
her in line. Yeah.
And keep her in line.
Yeah.
So like she wears a hearing aid that she found in the garbage,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it whistles all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that kind of business. And then she runs out of gas. She locks customers in the store. She forgets customers are in the store.
Wow.
And she locks customers in the store.
Yeah.
I'm probably rambling too much here. But the point is, I tried that.
So you left investment banking?
So I left for a while, did a leave of absence, went to Rhode Island to try to help run that business for a while. That didn't work. I went back to banking, and then I was like, okay,
None of this is working.
I'm going to go do this.
Comedy.
I sold my apartment.
Do you think that your dad being gone gave you a little bit of a window? Because you'd done what your dad needed you to do. You've
yeah.
been a lawyer, been an investment banker.
I think so. It's a really good question.
Yeah.
But it was really weird the way he died and the tie-in because he had a heart attack at the warehouse and they couldn't find anybody. And they brought him to the hospital. And the only ID, only contact number he had, I gave him my very first business card as like a thing. And that card was in his wallet. And they called me. Mm. And they had to tell me on the phone, which they don't like to do,
yeah.
that your father... And then I had to call everybody. So there was this weird tie-in. But... Yeah, I think it sort of it did, and it what ended up happening was I just had to face the reality of like I don't want to look back and say I should have. So what I did was I said I'm going to go do this, and I did it. I had a 2-bedroom co-op on the Upper East Side that I owned, I sold it. I unraveled my life. I sold everything I own except my Saab and my TV, and I moved to a rooming house in Queens.
You weren't married yet.
I wasn't married. She moved to Boston. She works in museums and started working in museums in Boston. I encouraged her to do it because that's a good comedy town. So I'd spend 3 days a week up there and 4 days a week in New York. I'm such an asshole. And I lived in it was a rooming house. There were two ex-cons, two recovering addicts, and a 300-pound phone sex operator who sold Herbalife diet products door to door. And we all shared a bathroom and a kitchen. And I lived in a little 10-by-12 room with a hot pot on the floor. And I went back to living like a student, a college student. And I had to start all over again. And I was doing it and doing it and doing it. And I was getting stiffed on money and working horrible gigs. And people had control over my life in that world who I would not have let, like, Xerox documents in my other life. And long story short, I got so frustrated, I went back to Wall Street. I said, this comedy thing isn't for me. And then 2 months later, I'd sworn off comedy. I'm back on Wall Street at another investment bank, Bear Stearns, doing M&A deals. And a month and a half into that, I had sworn off comedy. I was back in the clubs doing comedy again. And then I finally got the permission I needed. And it came from a 65-year-old CEO of a corporation that we were selling. He had seen me the night before on TV. I had taped something months ago and forgot about it. And he goes, did I see you on TV? He goes, no. I go, yeah, you were doing that? No. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I thought, I'm dead to rights. This is in front of like 10 other bankers and lawyers. He says this in his conference room. I go, yeah, that was me. And I'm just waiting and waiting. Long, pregnant pause. He's like, it was great. He goes, hey, everybody, my investment banker's a comedian. What do you think of that? I became his favorite, and it turned out, it humanized me to him. I wasn't just this money-grubbing thing. And I think I needed that permission from that world to go do it.
Yeah.
And when I got it, I think I was okay with it.
Yeah,
I'd like to say that I was a more independent thinker than that, but I
no,
wasn't.
No, I
you
understand.
I mean?
I totally get that.
And
Because you had invested so much in that world that
yeah.
you needed it to.
And it was a really tumultuous time. Like, I was so torn. Like, if I saw you on the street and you looked reasonable, I'd come up to you and ask you your opinion. Look, I got this dilemma. I literally was, like, asking every person in my life, like, what I should do. Because I was being a pussy and I just couldn't shit or get off the pot. And I finally was like, I think the big thing was I didn't want to look back and say I should have. And I felt like I could always go back to law or banking in some form. Maybe not at the highest level where I was. Because once you get out of that track, it's you're out.
I just think your story is really important. I mean, you were able to achieve at a high level that a lot of people can't do, but it just as a model for, you know, don't quit your day job, work hard, train at something, and then follow your passion. To me, that's kind of an interesting model.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I felt awkward talking about it on stage, and I talk about it now, and it really. I have people come up and talk to me about that more than anything
yeah,
else.
I'm sure.
I had a guy 3 weeks ago, a dentist, 45. He goes, I always wanted to write the great American novel, but then I got the house, and then we got a second house, and I had the two kids, and he goes, I still want to do it. And I go, well, look, I told him it picked me. I didn't pick
it. But he shouldn't have not been a dentist. You know what I mean?
That, right.
He made a difference by doing that, and he got important training. And
I just told him that
you have to eventually go do it.
Right, but I did tell him you have to decide if you want to go through a little bit of pain again. Like, you can't just make a nice jump and go, okay, I'm making $350,000 a year as a dentist, and I'm going to make $350,000 a year as a writer. Like, I literally was going 100 – I was driving 90 miles one way to make $50 and then getting stiffed on top of it, okay? This is a guy that, like, 2 months earlier – was closing $1.5 billion deal that affected 25,000 people who worked for the company. And I had this fucking alcoholic – I go to a club, Joker's Wild in New Haven. They're open to the new management, so I don't care. The guy was an ass. I walk in. Owner doesn't pay the bills because he's dealing drugs out of the place. And I walk into the – I was opening for Elaine Boozler at the time. And I walk into the showroom, and it's February, and everybody's in their overcoats. And I can see my breath. Guy's not paying his oil bill, but he's doing shows anyway. I did 5 shows for $50 a show for $250. I get off stage, and he played this classic game. He goes, I go up to the bouncer, the dorm. I go, I need to get my check. He goes, the boss left. He didn't leave you a check.
No.
That was the part. That was the hardest part. That was where my wife had to peel me off the ceiling because I'm like, it's
not fair.
Not only wasn't fair, but it kind of – it made me feel dirty, and it made me feel insignificant, and that part of it. But so when people come up to me, and they do a lot now when I talk about it, like That's a great story. I always wanted to, you know, I always wanted to be a musician, but my parents really wanted to be an engineer, so I did it. And I say, just go do it. The thing you're doing isn't a bad thing. I don't regret having a law degree. It's a great way of training the mind to think a certain way.
Exactly.
It helps me as a creatively. It helps me as a writer, and it helps me in conduct my business. But I think the other thing I really like is I like building my own brand, like the way you have, you know. And I'm sure you, which is something you do as a physician, but not to the extent that you're doing.
No, it's very
now.
Different.
And I get as much satisfaction out of that.
Well, it's creating.
Yeah,
it's,
you know. And so I think ultimately that's where my heart was always going. And
all right.
But it was scary.
We got to wrap up. Yeah. I'm driving everybody to your website. You guys understand now why I like Paul Mercurio. But it's without the R. And mecurio.com. Also, Sideshow TV. SideshowNetwork.tv and iTunes. Get Paul's.
And
you can listen him talk to Paul McCartney.
And you can listen me talk to Susan Pinsky and Drew Pinsky.
And you and I will do another one soon.
Yes, please.
Facebook, Twitter, at Paul Mercurio.
This has been great.
I think my listeners get it now. So they will immediately charge on over to your website.
Yes,
so.
Not to that Australian guy.
Yeah.
Who's now doing a beer reality show in Australia.
And he is. And you can get your stand-up dates there, too.
Yes, I'm touring all over the country right through the end of the year. I've got a very full schedule, so I'm everywhere.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious.
Thanks.
We'll see you all next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. This is Corolla Digital.